From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, presumptive presidential nominees Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump outlined very different visions to fight terrorism in the wake of the mass shooting at the Orlando nightclub. Clinton discussed bolstering our intelligence community, stricter gun control, and fighting ISIS in the Middle East. Trump repeated calls for a temporary Muslim immigration ban and attacked radical Islam. This hour on Point, the Orlando mass shooting and the 2016 presidential race. You can join us on air or online. What did you hear in Clinton and Trump's speeches? Who gets your attention? Your vote. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Before we turn to Clinton and Trump's speeches yesterday, we want to get the latest from Orlando. Joining me now is Catherine Welch, news director for NPR affiliate WMFE. Catherine, welcome back to On Point, and thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
What's the latest today in the investigation from Orlando?
So the focus seems to really be on the shooter, Omar Mateen. The FBI says the 29-year-old appears to be a, quote, homegrown extremist. He had touted support for other terrorist groups, but the FBI says there's no indication he was directed from outside the country. Reporters have been doing their forensics, piecing together tweets to get a fuller picture of what happened during the hostage situation in the bathroom. So the first shots were fired at 2 o'clock Sunday morning. The police barged in at 5 o'clock in the morning. People are trying to get a sense of what happened in those 3 hours while, you know, I believe 30 people were stuck in the bathrooms. Now, Orlando's police chief, John Mina, told me that no shots were fired between 2 and 5 o'clock Sunday morning once it became a hostage situation. Orlando's mayor says 39 of the victims were killed at the club. The other 10 died in the hospitals. And this is just so grim. Workers removed the bodies from the clubs four at a time, loaded them into white vans, and all of them were at the medical examiner's office by 11 o'clock Sunday night.
What about this news that the FBI is trying to determine whether the gunman scouted other gay venues or other potential targets, including Disney World? What do you know about that, Catherine?
So People.com is reporting that the shooter scouted Disney World. Now, it said Disney World and this other part of Disney properties. It's called Downtown Disney. It's more like an open-air mall than what you would think of Disney World. Mm-hmm. It's a place you can go, you can shop, you can get something to eat. But right now, People.com is reporting that the FBI is looking into it. Also, the Orlando Sentinel reports that Mateen was seen at the club on many occasions.
Right, at the Pulse nightclub other times, not just that night.
Yes, and one person said he'd sit by himself and drink alone, or he'd drink so much that he would become belligerent. Now, this is a club largely for younger members of Orlando's gay community, and Mateen was 29 years old, around the same age as many of his victims.
What about the reports that the gunman may have used several different gay dating apps?
Okay, so questions are surfacing about Mateen's sexuality. His father has suggested that Mateen acted out of an anti-gay hatred, but the Los Angeles Times sources a Pulse regular who says that he and the shooter chatted over an app called Jacked. The LA Times reports that that person went right to the FBI and turned over his phone.
And what about the victims who are still hospitalized, Catherine?
Oh, okay, the ones who are still hospitalized, we heard yesterday evening there were five that were in grave condition, which means the death toll could rise. We're getting an update from the hospital later today. Six are on ventilators.
Catherine Welch, news director for Orlando's WMFE, the local NPR affiliate there. Really appreciate you taking the time today with us, Catherine. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now to the speeches from Clinton and Trump. Joining me from Washington is Ginger Gibson, campaign reporter for Reuters covering Donald Trump. Ginger, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me again.
Also from Washington, Sahil Kapoor joins us, national political reporter for Bloomberg News covering Hillary Clinton. Welcome back to you, Sahil.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And from Washington, Michael Crowley joins us, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Hi, Jane.
So two very different speeches yesterday. Donald Trump first spent a lot of time on immigration. He renewed his calls to ban Muslim immigration. Here he is yesterday in a speech in Manchester, New Hampshire.
When I'm elected, I will suspend immigration from areas of the world where there is a proven history of terrorism against the United States, Europe, or our allies, until we fully understand how to end these threats.
Ginger, is that practical? Is it legal?
It's a great question. It would be very difficult to actually implement a ban like this. We have, through history, seen limits or bans on immigration from specific countries, which seemed to be a little bit of movement from Donald Trump, who had previously said all foreign-born Muslims. There was lots of criticism that that was not legal or possible. I think at the end of the day, no matter which way Donald Trump approaches this, he's going to have a hard time getting Congress to approve of anything. He did suggest he could maybe do it on his own yesterday. That would likely result in a lengthy court battle, as we've seen President Obama trying to do the reverse and letting people in, is setting a bit of a precedent. His troubles there. But I think that we're seeing Donald Trump try to find a way to make this something that could happen. But it would still be rather difficult to actually implement some of these proposals.
Hillary Clinton pushed back on this point, on this Muslim immigration ban. Here she is yesterday in Cleveland attacking Trump's immigration ban.
Inflammatory anti-Muslim rhetoric and threatening to ban the families and friends of Muslim Americans, as well as millions of Muslim business people and tourists from entering our country, hurts the vast majority of Muslims who love freedom and hate terror.
Sahil Kapoor, what was Hillary Clinton's message to the Muslim community yesterday?
Jane, it was the antithesis of Donald Trump's speech in every way. She talked about building coalitions and partnerships to condemn hate, to attack what she called the poisonous and metastasizing ideology of radicalism. She talked about making lone wolves like the shooter a priority to catch and to work with American allies and the Muslim world to achieve these goals. The most important part of her speech to me was that she made a bright red line between radical jihadists like the shooter in Orlando and the Muslim world writ large. And in this regard, she's in line with not just President Obama, but also President Bush before him, who understood that it was very dangerous to make an enemy or to create a perception that the United States was at war with the entire Muslim world, which is, you know, 1.5 to 2 billion people. The theory here being that the United States needs their cooperation and their alliance in order to effectively combat terrorism. Mm.
Michael Crowley, two very different messages, obviously, and two very different tones. What did you hear on this point?
Well, certainly two different tones, which we've come to expect from months of watching Trump and Clinton, years of watching Clinton, of course. On some level, I saw two different conceptions of what America is. You know, for Hillary Clinton, her response to this was to reaffirm the unity of a multicultural society that welcomes immigrants, integrates outsiders, you know, kind of implicitly accepts a certain level of risk and uncertainty associated with that in the name of a kind of an American ideal that she celebrates, although she was, of course, quite firm in insisting she would keep the country safe and prevent terror attacks. In the case of Trump, you see him articulating a vision of a different kind of an America. It's more reminiscent of an America that was more homogenous and closed and sees the outside world and sees outsiders primarily as a threat, not as a source of America's strength, and I think played to fear and xenophobia, whereas Clinton was arguing that those emotions not only empower Islamist enemies of the country, mm-hmm. but sort of undermine the unity and greatness of the country. So, you know, there's a really kind of high altitude difference in vision of what makes America strong and what America's core identity ought to be.
So on this point, there was also a lot of back and forth yesterday between the candidates about the term radical Islamic terrorism. Here is on Fox and Friends yesterday morning, Donald Trump saying that Obama needs to use those words, radical Islamic terrorism.
You know, people can't believe it. People cannot they cannot believe that President Obama is acting the way he acts and can't even mention the words radical Islamic terrorism.
And here is Hillary Clinton responding on NBC's Today Show to Trump's attack on her unwillingness to use the phrase radical Islam.
From my perspective, it matters what we do, not what we say. It mattered that we got bin Laden, not what name we called him. But if he is somehow suggesting I don't call this for what it is, he hasn't been listening. I have clearly said that we face terrorist enemies who use Islam to justify slaughtering innocent people. We have to stop them, and we will. We have to defeat radical jihadist terrorism, and we will. And to me, radical jihadism, radical Islamism, I think they mean the same thing. I'm happy to say either, but that's not the point.
In fact, she did use that term, radical Islamic terrorism, yesterday. Sahil, is that a change for her?
I think what Hillary Clinton is trying to do is walk the line between, you know, for one, calling this and describing this what it is, but also, as I mentioned before, being very careful not to give the impression, as President Obama has tried to avoid doing, and President Bush also tried to avoid doing, that the United States is at war with Islam. That's why President Obama and Bush have tiptoed around the words radical Islam. That's why Hillary Clinton prefers not to use them. But her point was that it doesn't, you know, as you heard her say, it doesn't matter so much what you call them. She's looking at this more from a pragmatic, what does it mean? What is the, you know, what is the impact and what are the downsides and consequences of using that phrase, and what does it actually get us? Whereas Donald Trump is capitalizing on a very popular, you know, view within the Republican Party and the conservative tent that you must call this radical Islam, and somehow not doing it means you're cowering in the face of this grave threat.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the response to the Orlando mass shooting by the presumptive presidential nominees this hour. And you can join the conversation. Is Trump right to call for a ban on all immigrants from certain parts of the world? What about Clinton's call for gun control? We're speaking this hour with Ginger Gibson from Reuters, Sahil Kapoor from Bloomberg, and Michael Crowley from Politico. Before the break, we were talking about the term radical Islamic terrorism. Donald Trump quite adamant that this term should be used. Michael Crowley, I'm curious why President Obama does not use that term, why he refuses to use it.
Well, I think Sahil put his finger on it before the break when he said that there is a great concern about turning this battle against ISIS into something that even Muslims who don't embrace ISIS's radical ideology see as some kind of holy war, and that it doesn't appear it's important to the administration, as it was to George W. Bush, who spoke very specifically and eloquently about this. It's important that our counterterror efforts against groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda not be read in the Muslim world as a kind of crusade, as Christianity versus Islam, and that it not appear that the West sees Islam as a fundamentally radical religion at its core. That in the view of not only President Obama and his aides, but you know, a lot of really well-versed analysts in this field would be counterproductive and could cost the U.S. the vital support of moderate Muslims or Muslims who may be sort of on the fence, who we need to, if not openly ally with us, not give sort of aid and comfort to the radical fraction of their population.
So another element in their respective speeches yesterday was the issue of gun control. Hillary Clinton spent a large part of her speech talking about it. Here she is in Cleveland yesterday saying that new gun regulations are necessary to fight terrorism.
If the FBI is watching you for suspected terrorist links, you shouldn't be able to just go buy a gun with no questions asked. And you shouldn't be able to exploit loopholes and evade criminal background checks by buying online or at a gun show.
So, Sahil Kapoor, what are her proposals? What are Clinton's proposals?
Gun control has been a centerpiece of Hillary Clinton's campaign right from the start. And there, you know, gun control advocates have told me that she's brought an aggression to this issue that you know, no one has seen since her husband ran for president in 1992 and eventually got some stuff done. But what she wants to do is require universal background checks, limit high-capacity ammunition magazines, ban assault weapons. She talked about yesterday, she said the words, weapons of war have no place on our streets. She also talked about the need to stop people who are on an FBI terror watch list from buying a gun, which current federal law allows them to do. This actually, interestingly, came up last December in the Senate and as an amendment proposed by Dianne Feinstein of California, and all but one Democrat voted for it. In other words, voted to stop terror suspects from being able to buy a gun, and all but one Democrat Republicans voted against it, and it was shot down. And you saw Democrats yesterday try to revive this and make this a big issue. The Republicans who oppose this idea cite due process concerns. They say this is a secretive list that, you know, the people who are on this list have not proven to have done anything wrong. So that's the debate we're having. But I suspect we're going to hear a lot more about this. And I think we can hear a lot more. We probably will hear a lot more about this from the Clinton campaign as well.
And what about the Trump campaign, Ginger Gibson? Where does Donald Trump stand on this issue in the wake of Orlando? Was anything different?
Trump has maintained his position that he is opposed to gun control legislation. And I think that we're going to see in this election cycle gun control actually be a point that the two sides are willing to engage in. The last several cycles, candidates on both sides, when they've gotten to the general election, have all but stopped talking about guns. And we're happy to do so for the most part, leaving the issue alone. We saw some suggestion that Barack Obama was anti-guns, but not really a daily talking point on the campaign trail. This time, I think it's going to be different. We heard Donald Trump yesterday saying that Hillary Clinton would abolish the Second Amendment. That's obviously not true. He's speaking probably in a bit of hyperbole, as he likes to do. But he's going to be saying those things every day, and she's going to be happily hitting the drum on the other side of the issue.
Michael Crowley, the AR-15 was the assault weapon that was used in the Orlando shooting. It was also used in the Newtown Elementary School massacre. Is it as easy to buy as a handgun? I understand it was once banned. Is that correct?
I believe the AR-15 fell under the assault weapons ban, which expired in 2004 after 10 years. And, you know, the AR-15 is a gun that we have seen repeatedly in these kinds of mass shootings. It allows a shooter to fire off quite a lot of ammo quite quickly. It is not, as is sometimes misunderstood, a machine gun where you pull the trigger and it just unloads a stream of bullets. You have to it's one trigger pull per bullet, but still all too efficient for those purposes. A complicated thing about the assault weapons ban that expired in 2004 is that it's not clear how effective it was. These ban, you know, the language was easily circumvented by people who wanted to modify weapons. Singling out certain classes of weapons in the law turns out to be trickier than it appears. As the other guests have noted, there's support for doing something now among Democrats that we haven't seen in quite a long time. It just doesn't look like Republicans are budging at all.
And Jane, if I could add briefly.
Yes, please.
Donald Trump is in a sort of a weird, ambiguous position on the issue of terror suspects buying guns. He said in November in an interview on ABC, he was asked point blank, should an FBI terror suspect be allowed to buy a gun? And he said, no, I would keep them away. But and I spoke to Trump's campaign manager yesterday, who told me he still holds that view. Now, having said that, Trump has also said has also been hesitant to support new legislation to this effect, and he suggested that current law already covers it, which it actually doesn't. So his position on that is a little bit ambiguous. But as Ginger rightly noted, he's very staunchly pro Second Amendment. He's very staunchly anti gun control.
Well, from gun control to another part of the speeches yesterday. Yesterday on Fox and Friends, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, made multiple references to President Obama that have been criticized for implying that Obama was implicated in the terrorist attack in Orlando. We've edited together three comments for this interview.
We're led by a man that either is not tough not smart, or he's got something else in mind. And there's something going on. It's inconceivable. Right. There's something going on.
Well, Donald Trump...
He doesn't get it, or he gets it better than anybody understands. It's one or the other, and either one is unacceptable.
And here's Josh Earnest in the White House press briefing room dismissing Trump's attack on Obama when asked about it by the press.
When you are focused on something as big as safeguarding the country and combating violent extremism, it's important not to get distracted by things that are so small.
So, Ginger Gibson, here is Trump saying Obama is either not tough, not smart, or he's got something else in mind. He said that three times in three different interviews. What is he suggesting here?
You know, it's sometimes difficult with Donald Trump because the something else in mind could be that he's thinking about golfing or that he's a secret Muslim that harbors sympathy for terrorists. And he's not saying, and partly because he's going to let everyone decide what he thinks that means. We saw yesterday him lashing out at news organizations, including the Washington Post, that interpreted it to mean that he was suggesting Barack Obama was somehow complicit or involved in the shootings. He left it ambiguous. I didn't get explanations from his campaign when I asked what exactly he was trying to say there. But there was, for a reason, a lot of people who assumed that he was suggesting Barack Obama harbors some sympathies. We know that historically Donald Trump has suggested more than once that Barack Obama is actually a Muslim when we know he is a Christian, and has said more than once that Barack Obama was harboring some secret motives that we don't know about. Now, in the next sentence, he says, I just think he's not smart and not good. And I'm a better leader. But there was that nod to maybe a little bit of the conspiratorial web that Donald Trump likes to poke with a stick sometimes.
A lot of listeners want to get in here. Let's go to Bill first in Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'd like to ask the panelists if anybody – I find that comment about Obama or those comments about Obama – so outrageous that I think the Republicans should drop him as their nominee. I think it's disqualifying. I wonder if I'm just way out in left field or if anybody agrees. I can't imagine that they would run somebody who holds those kinds of views.
Bill, thank you. Michael Crowley, I'll let you respond.
Well, I think it's a totally understandable reaction. I mean, to the extent that that is what Trump meant, and, you know, when you combine the language and also I think the tone in his voice is relevant here, a kind of suggestive tone. It's pretty shocking, and you know, I think would have been considered a basically disqualifying thing for a politician to say in the pre-Trump era. I mean, if some kind of mid-level member of Congress made a comment like that, it would be the defining thing that we knew about the guy for a long time, and there would be calls for him to resign, and you know, all kinds of uproar. Trump, in a way, has sort of you know, to use the old phrase, I think it's a criminology term, you know, define deviancy down. I mean, he says so many of these things that they kind of come and go and they're processed, and there's a shock and outrage every day. I guess the members of Congress who have and other Republican leaders who have endorsed him understand they're going to have to live with this, although you wonder if there at some point will be a tipping point. Last quick thing I would say is, as a thought experiment, you know, remember when some people on the left, although certainly never a Democratic presidential nominee, were suggesting that George Bush and Dick Cheney somehow knew that the 9/11 attacks were coming, that there were theories that, you know, they were looking forward to the wars that would ensue because they wanted to reward contractor buddies at places like Halliburton. And this was seen as totally loony, fringe stuff. Republicans were just hammering away at it and saying that it discredited, you know, huge portions of the left. It's not that different from what I heard Donald Trump say yesterday. So I totally understand the reaction.
So I hear Bill's reaction, the caller here, and I hear what you're saying, Michael Crowley. But I'm just curious, do these comments activate or strengthen the candidate's base of support? And what about in a broader in broader terms, in the broader electorate for a general election?
Well, look, I think in terms of his base, the proof is kind of in the pudding. He's been saying things like this for years. His comments about President Obama's birth certificate seem to be a huge hit on the right. Although I will say that, you know, eventually you saw elected Republican office holders sort of run from that issue and drop it. I think they were seeing damage it was causing among independents who thought that it was a bridge too far. But, you know, we'll see what happens in the polls, but we've been saying for months now, this is it. Trump has gone too far. The base may love it. You know, some small portion of his fan base may be cheering him on, but he's going to turn off moderates and independents. And the bottom never quite seems to fall out. So, you know, I'm hesitant to predict that this is the time that's going to be different.
Let's go to Michael in Southampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I missed a little bit of the conversation, but earlier your guest was talking about Trump's handling of the allusions to or suggestions of a conspiratorial role on the part of Obama, with, you know, going back to his days earlier on with flouting the notion of the birther conspiracy and so forth. So what I was interested in is the way in which, on the one hand, we have Trump, you know, by virtue of suggestion and so forth, playing on conspiratorial theories with sort of fast and loose way in which he plays with facts, while on the other hand, he's actually looking to refuse granting press credentials to such institutions as nothing less than the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering what your guests might want to say about that.
Michael, thank you. I appreciate it. Ginger Gibson, let me get you in here. Donald Trump has rescinded the press credentials of the Washington Post based on what he says is, quote, incredibly inaccurate coverage. He called the paper phony and dishonest. Ginger Gibson, what are they saying about this within the campaign?
Well, I can tell you that my colleagues at the Washington Post are not going to stop covering him because Donald Trump is not going to let them in the press area at his campaign rallies. The campaign, a source close to the campaign, told us yesterday that this could be a temporary ban, that he has temporarily banned publications, including Michael's, my former publication, Politico, from campaign rallies and then let them come back. I think what you're seeing is a man running for president who might have mastered the art of public relations better than anyone else. He has turned news organizations away before, but when he did it yesterday with the Washington Post, he did it in the most public way that he could, in a message channel, Facebook and Twitter, that are his most adherent followers reading those channels. He was doing it in a way to make sure everyone knew that he did it. And that's important here. And that's a lot of what we see from Donald Trump. You know, we as reporters who cover him often become frustrated about what exactly does he mean. Well, yesterday he said he would ban immigrants from countries that have had terrorist activities. Well, what countries? We don't know. They won't tell us. Mm. And that's a struggle we have. But I think that it's important to realize that much of that might be deliberate, that he doesn't want to give those details, and that at the same time he wants to provide details like banning the Washington Post when it is advantageous. The response I got on social media from writing that story yesterday was overwhelming. His followers were ecstatic that he banned the Washington Post, and liberals were enraged, and that's the exact kind of thing that Donald Trump wants to be doing.
Michael Crowley, Washington Post editor Marty Baron, said Trump's decision would be damaging to a free and independent press. Ginger mentioned that this is not the first time Trump has banned other news outlets from certain events over the past year. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think Marty Baron is right. I think what Ginger said is right. And I think that, you know, Trump says a lot of outrageous things, and people aren't entirely sure, you know, how much he will follow through on them as president. You know, you sometimes hear, I think, from somewhat sheepish supporters of his that a lot of what he's doing is theater. He's a reality show star. He loves to get media attention. But is he really going to change the presidency and governance in Washington as we know it? Well, maybe not. You know, he's not going to be. When you see actions like this, you know, they're not just outrageous statements. They are actually, he's actually taking actions. And, you know, granted, it may be temporary. Granted, the Post can still write about him, watch him on TV, go into his events as, you know, non-press. It does, you know, I just do, it's very alarming when you sort of see what is a little bit of an authoritarian impulse that he's actually willing to act on that would be totally unprecedented in a White House. And I think that's quite disturbing.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Orlando mass shooting, terrorism, and the very different visions moving forward for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. You can join the conversation. Will the Orlando mass shooting, the worst in American history, change the course of this presidential race? We're speaking this hour with Ginger Gibson from Reuters, Sahil Kapoor from Bloomberg, and Michael Crowley from Politico. The FBI said today that they are highly confident that the Orlando killer was radicalized online. Yesterday in Cleveland, Hillary Clinton said we need to do a better job countering jihadist propaganda online.
As president, I will work with our great tech companies from Silicon Valley to Boston to step up our game. We have to do a better job intercepting ISIS's communications, tracking and analyzing social media posts, and mapping jihadist networks, as well as promoting credible voices who can provide alternatives to radicalization.
Sahil Kapoor, what are Clinton's plans, broadly speaking?
I think her plan, she was talking about, you know, I think in broad terms about the fact that as terrorist methods advance and get better in terms of recruiting and trying to spread their ideology, so should counterterrorism. Now, I don't think she's gotten into great detail about how she wants to do this, how she wants to work with companies in Silicon Valley to better intercept these communications. But it's certainly a work in progress, and we should expect to see, you know, a lot more of that from her.
What about Trump, Ginger Gibson? Where does he stand on this?
Trump has been, in some ways, actually agreed with Clinton about increasing how the internet is used, how intelligence agencies use the internet to track down people who are being radicalized online. We saw him say yesterday morning in interviews that he thought that there should be a more aggressive pushback online. But he also was critical of Clinton and the administration on this front, saying that he thought that the administration was tying the hands of the intelligence agencies, stopping them from doing some of the things that they could do. I don't have great details on what exactly he wants them to be able to do that they're not. He didn't give us any of that information, so we might be hearing a little bit of rhetoric than policy. But he did say that there needs to be a more aggressive intelligence front. I think the big takeaway from Donald Trump's speech yesterday on that front was that he blames immigration. We heard him say the shooter would not have been here had we not let his parents come into the country. Those were his words. And I think that that harkens to the heart of a lot of his message. America first. We have to stop worrying about these people who are coming here. We have to stop letting people come here. And if we stop doing that, then that'll solve a lot of the problems.
Michael Crowley, both Clinton and Trump laid out plans to fight ISIS, which include increased bombing. And I'm curious how their plans differ from President Obama's current strategy.
Well, Trump has said a lot of different things about how to fight ISIS, including the assertion that he has a foolproof plan that he can't reveal for fear of tipping them off. But I don't think either of them is dramatically departing from what the president's doing. Hillary Clinton, in particular, I think, is arguing basically a status quo approach. But one thing that struck me about her speech is that although months ago she did propose creating a no-fly zone in Syria, which is an idea that President Obama, we've heard it from several Republicans as well as a few conservative Democrats. It's an idea that President Obama has derided, has said would be very risky and costly. Clinton doesn't really talk about that idea as much as she used to. She's kind of let it go and doesn't emphasize it. And so really it's kind of a continued more of the same, increased airstrikes is an easy thing for people to say. It's not really clear that more airstrikes is what we need or would make a dramatic difference. But in neither case is anyone willing to say it's time to insert a large, contingent of U.S. ground forces, you know, U.S. Army troops like we saw in the thousands in the Iraq War. Everyone seems to agree that, the force has to consist of Arabs in the region, but that is much more easily said than done. So I don't think we have any breakthrough ideas on the table here. And to some degree, I see Hillary Clinton stepping away a bit from one of the bolder aspects of her plans to fight ISIS.
Let me get President Obama in here in the Oval Office yesterday discussing the current conversation about terrorism and gun control.
My concern is that we start getting into a debate, as has happened in the past, which is an either-or debate. And the suggestion is either we think about something as terrorism and we ignore the problems with easy access to firearms, or it's all about firearms and we ignore the role, the very real role that organizations like ISIL have in generating extremist views inside this country. And it's not an either-or, it's a both-and.
Michael Crowley, is that right? Is it an either-or? It's not either-or, it's both-and.
Right. I mean, look, this problem is, there's no silver bullet here, and it's incredibly frustrating for the president, I'm sure, when people are really scared and this problem feels like it's getting worse, not better. And there's rhetoric out there that suggests we can take, you know, some kind of bold, immediate, dramatic action and make people markedly safer. But that's just not the case. And, you know, even if you take as an example Hillary Clinton's language about policing and mapping social media more carefully, you know, that is a slog. That is really hard work. It involves, you know, countless subjective judgments. You crack down on one social media outlet and another one pops up somewhere else. I thought that FBI Director James Comey described the dilemma that his agency faces in trying to track terror suspects very well yesterday when he said not only is the FBI being asked to locate a needle in a haystack, in addition, the FBI needs to determine which pieces of hay might eventually become needles. I think that, you know, the best that we can hope to do is try to come up with, you know, a dozen different policy approaches that lower the risk fractionally by a couple of percentage points. And hopefully in the aggregate, it's, you know, in the aggregate, you've reduced the overall risk of attacks like this by 50% or 75%. But there aren't simple, stark choices or solutions to be had here.
Let's get Lanny in here from Florida. Lanny, welcome to the program.
How are you?
Hello. Go ahead.
Listen, I believe that we are certainly at war with ISIS and with those factors that are radical Muslims in the Far East. I believe that people who immigrate from that part of the world who are Muslims, you know, when compare this to World War II when we were fighting Nazi Germany. People who were sympathizers of Nazis and people who were sympathizers of Germany, even people that were just German by descent, were often under investigation because we are in a brutal war where people were doing the same things as the ISIS people are doing to people now, even worse in some cases. You know, so compare those two, and maybe there's the CIA, the FBI, or some branch of this government can get aggressive about finding out who these people are when they immigrate from that part of the world, and they are Muslims. Are they radical?
All right, Lanny, thank you. Let's get Lori in here from Columbus Junction, Iowa. Lori, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a couple comments. It seems like you're really anti-Trump, but I believe that Donald Trump is saying what many, many Americans are feeling, and we just feel like we don't have a voice. I don't believe that Obama's a Christian. I believe that he backs the Muslim community. He has said so on many occasions that he will back that Muslim community. And why aren't we aggressively attacking the ISIS sites? Why are we just sitting back doing nothing?
Lori, thank you. No, I hear your point, and I'm glad you called. Ginger Gibson, you must hear that a lot on the campaign trail.
I do hear that a lot, and I heard that a lot from folks yesterday. I think that Lori just sort of put to words a little bit. I could hear, I suspect, in her voice of frustration. Why aren't we doing something? Why aren't we doing more? Why aren't there more attacks? And I think that echoes what Michael was saying a moment ago, which is that people want a bold action. They want something to happen. And they don't even know what it is. You know, people can't tell you, we should be striking these specific targets. Well, because I don't know that
that anyone quite knows that answer. If you ask Lindsey Graham, who probably follows this and knows the military tactics behind it, he might not be able to tell you exactly what locations we should be attacking. But people want something done, and I think that's why Donald Trump reverberates with so many people. He's ready to do something. Even if he's not telling us what it is he's going to do, he's ready to do it, and he's going to take action. And people want someone who's going to do something. And that strikes at the heart of the frustration of a war, or two wars, or maybe now this is a third, that have stretched for a decade, and people just want something done.
And Lauren, Jane, could I add?
Yes, please, go ahead.
So your guests, I think, expressed exactly the sentiment that Donald Trump is capitalizing on. And he, you know, unlike Hillary Clinton, unlike other political figures, including his own Republican leaders, he's portraying this as a, you know, an existential threat to us that we need to take radical steps to stop. Everyone from House Speaker Paul Ryan to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has opposed his Muslim ban, but he's gotten support for that from the Republican base at levels of 2/3 or as much as 70%. The country overall is more divided on this, but this is the disconnect between the political class and you know, ordinary voters out there who are supportive of taking these radical steps, even if they seem impractical, even if they could potentially backfire. There is an emotional, a visceral fear that he is just capitalizing on in a way that no one else has in a long time. And that is critical, absolutely critical to understanding his support.
Go ahead, Michael.
Jane, yeah, one more quick point, which is, you know, there's a little bit of a running joke in the White House referring back to a press conference that President Obama had. I think it was in the wake of San Bernardino. It could have been Paris. It was one of these horrible attacks. And the president laid out at great discursive length, you know, all the things that he's doing, you know, social media and the air campaign in Syria and Iraq and the peace negotiations that John Kerry is trying to pull together to settle Syrian civil war. And finally, a reporter, you know, having heard all this, stood up and asked the president, you know, people want to know, why can't we take out the bastards? You know, that's I believe a direct quote. And I think that, you know, in the White House, there's a kind of rolling of eyes and a repetition of that line to suggest they can't, you know, people just don't want to hear what President Obama has to say about all the things that he's doing, you know, a checklist of like 6 or 8 things that has actually a pretty broad consensus in the counterterror community, although with obviously some dissent. But it comes down to, why can't we just take out the bastards? People want that satisfying response. And I think it's, you know, frankly, crazy making in the Obama administration. But a lot of Americans, I think, share the view.
Laurie, glad you called with your perspective. Thank you. Let's go to Irfan in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Irfan. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good day. And basically, my comment is that every time these attacks happen, we are always lumping Muslim community into one. I am practicing Muslim. I'm proud to be an American. I'm constructive, productive, tax-paying citizen. I have 2 kids who go to public schools. My wife is a physician. I'm a physical therapist. So at the end of the day, when American community is made up of hodgepodge and soup of immigrants, when we finger point, marginalize, and demonize to the point that everybody has to apologize for somebody else's action, I refuse to do that. At the end of the day, if you're a constructive and productive citizen, you do not have to apologize for somebody else's action. That is the basic tenet of democracy.
Irfan, thank you. A lot of comments reflecting that online. One from Twitter says, as a veteran, I served alongside many proud, heroic Americans who were Muslim. No questioning their patriotism. Let's see, Ginger Gibson, I'll let you respond.
I will say that we as a culture, as a country, have a trap of doing that. And we saw Hillary Clinton yesterday pushing back at that, saying that they're peaceful Muslims. And I will say, as a Mexican-American, we lump all of the Hispanics together. And my industry is really awful about doing that, as if it is a monolithic voting block, or as if everyone who came as a descendant of a Hispanic nation must all think and act the same. And we know that that's not true. We know that fair-complected people who came from immigrants of lots of countries don't all think and act the same. That's clear. And you're right. I think that we hear people trying to make the point that people who are Islamic, people who follow the Muslim faith, they are not a monolithic group. They do not think and act the same, and that they are not, you know, you in Massachusetts are not going to be responsible for a guy in Orlando who you've never met or seen, likely probably never interacted with and never would have otherwise. And that's a really complicated part of our society and our culture, and trying to explain these things to people and have productive conversations.
One quick last call here from Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Hi, Terry. We're short on time. If you could be brief. Thanks for calling.
Yes. How are we going to stop immigration from the United States to the United States, which is where most of the terrorism actually has come from? And my deepest sympathy goes to the families and friends, but especially the ones that rejected their gay victims. And the 9/11 transporter route does not available here in the sticks.
Terry, thank you. Thank you very much. Michael Crowley, I'll give you the last word in response.
Can I answer with a question mark? I'm not sure I totally understood the caller's question, to be honest.
So where do we go from here then? We'll move on. Where do we go after these big policy speeches, Trump, Clinton laying out their ideas? What now?
Yeah. Look, I have to say something very pessimistic, which is I think we need to brace ourselves for the next one of these. I hate to say that out loud, but I think that this problem is going to continue. It's going to be really difficult to solve. There's not a clear consensus on what to do. And I think, among other things, it's important that this country have a sense of resilience and understand that we can't let this define our national life, and hopefully not define our politics, even as we work really hard to try to stop more of these tragedies.
Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Thanks so much, as always, Michael. Great to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, covering Hillary Clinton. Sahil, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Ginger Gibson, campaign reporter for Reuters, covering Donald Trump. Ginger, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.